of BC. Enjoy breakfast on the beach for only $4.95, served daily from 7 a.m. till 11 p.m. Say you heard this ad and receive 5% off lunch and dinner items until May 31st, 2012. Enjoy breakfast, lunch, or dinner at the newly opened NSCS Discovery Restaurant at 1515 Discovery in Jericho Park and support a local social enterprise.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, May 4th. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Nina Kurgia. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia, to our campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5:07 and time for another hour of Independent News. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. Also stay tuned for Democracy Now!, where Amy Goodman gives you an update on the May Day protests that have been going on around the world.
All this plus your weekend weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for your UBC campus and local headlines.
An innovative UBC program has provided more than $1 million in funding to help BC communities promote their unique histories to audiences around the world thanks to digitization. Launched by the Irving K. Barber Learning Center in 2006, the BC History Digitization Program, or the BCHDP, provides matching grants to support projects that make BC heritage freely accessible to the public via the internet. In total, the BCHDP has awarded more than $1.02 million for 120 grants over the past 6 years. The director of the IKV Learning Center, Simon Neem, says, quote, "Since its inception, the BCHDP has been dedicated to helping libraries, archives, museums, and post-secondary institutions share their unique resources with a broader audience. The BCHDP not only provides funding to make BC's history available to the world, it also represents an investment in our communities." End quote. 66 of the 120 grants given out over the years have supported projects based outside of the Lower Mainland. Nearly one-third of the projects have focused on the digitization of photographs. One of this year's recipients is the West Vancouver Memorial Library, which will use the funds to add 1,500 digitized images to its online repository. A complete list of 2012 funding recipients can be found on the Irving K. Barber Learning Center's website under the BC History Digitization Program.
The University of British Columbia's midwifery program will double in size over the next 5 years. Supported by an increase in funding from the province of British Columbia. The Ministry of Advanced Education worked with UBC and the Ministry of Health to determine the number of BC midwife graduates that are needed to help meet the need for greater access to such services. Starting this fall, first-year spaces in the midwifery program will grow from 10 to 20. Once the expansion is complete, the number of students in the four-year bachelor's degree program will total 40. UBC will receive $1.914 million in one-time funding and an increase of $833,920 in ongoing operating funding for the FADES expansion. Dr. Gavin Stewart, UBC's Vice Provost Health and Dean of the Faculty of Medicine, said that, quote, "The Faculty of Medicine is grateful for the province that the province has expanded funding for its midwifery program. The doubling of enrollment and the hiring of additional faculty will enable more women and their families, particularly in BC's underserved communities, to obtain expert care before and during their deliveries and will allow for research to make midwifery even more effective in the future." End quote. The midwifery program, part of the Faculty of Medicine's Department of Family Practice, was created 10 years ago, a few years after the province recognized midwives as primary care professionals and began regulating the profession. The program is one of only four midwife training programs in Canada.
A 28-year-old emerging writer from Vancouver has won the $5,000 RBC Bronwyn Wallace Award for her short story, Elk-Headed Man. Jen Neal was named winner this Wednesday at an event in Toronto by the Writers' Trust of Canada. The prize recognizes writers under the age of 35 who are unpublished in book form. The award has a reputation for tapping some of Canada's finest writers, including novelist Alyssa York, who presented the prize. Elk-Headed Man includes characters from Neal's novel In Progress. Neal is working towards an MFA in creative writing at the University of British Columbia, and is the executive editor in charge of circulation and promotion at Prism International, which is a quarterly magazine based out of UBC's creative writing department.
A Nobel Prize-winning BC economist, Mark Jacquard, is planning to get arrested blocking a coal train in White Rock on Saturday. He hopes to his dramatic act of civil disobedience will raise awareness about Canada's expanding role in global consumption of fossil fuels. Jacquard is an environmental economics professor at Simon Fraser University, and he said he came to the decision to stop the BNSF train from reaching the port, quote, "very reluctantly," end quote. But he claims that the Conservative government's claim on its track to reduce the country's greenhouse gas emissions by 2012 is patently false. Jacquard says that if expansion of Canada's oil sands and comparable carbon sources around the world continues, the Earth is heading for a catastrophic 4-degree rise in temperatures within this century. The last time the average temperature on the Earth was that high, 30 million years ago, sea levels were 40 to 50 meters higher. He also said that although no one alive today will be around by the time all the ice melts, continuing with business as usual in the name of the economy is, quote, "unjustifiable," end quote. Jacquard said this is the first time he has ever put himself in a position to be accused of civil disobedience and pledged his actions will be peaceful, nonviolent, and respectful of others. The group he is working with, Stop Coal, plans to block all coal coming from the U.S. through White Rock or export through BC's ports for 24 hours.
Vancouver City Council has voted in favor of a motion to officially oppose Kinder Morgan's planned pipeline expansion. The motion, introduced by Mayor Gregor Robertson, calls for the city to draft a letter to the federal government with their stance on the proposal and to create a bylaw demanding oil companies fully insure the city in the event of a spill. The mayor's speech was met by applause from the public gallery, and his motion enjoyed near unanimous support from councillors. Kinder Morgan hopes to increase the amount of crude oil being shipped out of the Burrard Inlet to 850,000 barrels a day from 300,000. The company plans to spend $5 billion to upgrade the pipeline, which runs from Edmonton to Burnaby and Washington State. But the plan first needs to undergo a review by the Federal National Energy Board. Vision Vancouver, the ruling civic party at City Hall, believe the plan has little bearing on Vancouver's economy and puts the environment and city's green industries at risk.
Unionized workers at the Vancouver Public Library, or VPL, are feeling the bite of $500,000 worth of planned staff hour cuts. Alexander Youngberg, president of the CUPE Local 391, said that its union members plan to protest the cuts by leafleting the May 9th Vancouver International Writers Festival at the VPL. The action comes as part of a planned protest by the 800-plus CUPE 391 members over the renegotiation of their collective agreement. Tensions between library workers and management have peaked as budget cuts and increased e-book circulation have put employee job security in doubt. The most recent flashpoint between workers and managers came when the Vancouver Public Library Board selected a prominent BC labor lawyer, Kim Thorne, to handle negotiations on their behalf. That move, said Youngberg, has left union members upset. Chief Librarian Sandra Singh said that Thorne's expertise will be critical because the VPL and CUPE 391 are to negotiate a pay and benefit package costing $30 million.
And those are your UBC campus and local headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for your local weekend weather forecast, as well as your provincial and national news.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
What do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia.
We now have your local weather forecast for the weekend, brought to you by Environment Canada. And tonight, it'll be partly cloudy with 30% chance of showers early this evening. The low of plus 5 degrees, which is quite cold for May. Saturday will be mainly cloudy with a 30% chance of showers and a high of 11 degrees. It should be sunny in some parts, so hopefully May is looking good for you.
Hopefully Cinco de Mayo will be nice and warm, although I doubt it because it's been a pretty cold May so far.
Hopefully we can have a good margarita outside. And Saturday night will be cloudy with the temperature steady at 8 degrees. And Sunday, a mix of sun and cloud with a 30% chance of showers again. A high of 12 degrees, except in the inland where it will be 15 degrees. A low of 8 degrees, so not that chilly. And that is your weekend weather forecast brought to you by Environment Canada.
Thank you, CJ. Look at you, you meteorologist, you.
Well, I do my thing.
Okay, well, it is now time for your provincial and national headlines.
According to a national poll by McAllister Opinion Research on issues studied by UBC public policy professor Paul Kershaw, 45% of Canadians say that government laws, services, and programs are irrelevant to their well-being and quality of life. However, Professor Kershaw says that these results are ironic because the poll also shows that around 90% of Canadians reject spending less on almost all aspects of social policy. In fact, the poll shows most want governments to spend as much, if not more, on a broad range of issues like families with kids, seniors, medical care, the environment, and poverty reduction. Despite the majority of Canadians wanting more social spending, 47% of Canadians also indicate they would vote against any politician who wanted to increase taxes for any reason. According to Kershaw, individual income tax is down nearly $38 billion a year, and we slashed sales tax by nearly $19 billion to a level far below a generation ago. Corporate taxes also dropped substantially, down nearly $18 billion. Professor Kershaw's research shows that Canadian spending on medical care and pensions is $80 billion higher today than it would be if we had 1976 budget decisions. Spending on these programs increased four times faster than the taxes that pay for them over the same period. Kershaw's research also shows that the dramatic pattern of tax cuts over the last decade does not play out neutrally across generations. Since expenditures on medical care and pensions grew while taxes declined, there are far fewer resources with which to adapt to the declining standard of living for today's generation under the age of 45.
The federal government says due to global warming and growing international interests in the melting Northwest Passage, it is imperative to improve surveillance in Canada's north. The research arm of the Department of National Defense is investing $10 million in a remote-controlled satellite surveillance project in the Barrow Strait, a small slice of Northwest Passage through which most vessels pass on their way westward along the route. The Northern Watch project was announced in 2007, and the first equipment set up the next year, only to be severely damaged by harsh weather conditions. Now, after several years of remedies and altering the equipment to make it stand up better to Arctic conditions, Ottawa has put a call out for a company to build a system that researchers can control from Halifax and eventually set up to be entirely automated. The system will include cameras mounted onto a building on land, taking images of passing ships based on radar signals they receive. At the same time, underwater acoustic sensors will listen for anything making noise underwater, from a submarine to a whale. However, UBC professor Michael Byers says that in some ways, Canada is playing catch-up. Ottawa's charts of Arctic exploration are still inferior to those of the former Soviet Union Anyway, that said, buyers think the money would be better spent on other things, including improving Northerners' standard of living.
Elections Canada has traced a computer from the Conservative campaign in Guelph, Ontario, to the account that paid for robocalls that falsely directed voters to the wrong polling station in the last federal election. Newly released court documents show investigator Al Matthews traced a PayPal account used to pay for the robocalls to the same IP address as the computer used by Andrew Prescott, the deputy campaign manager in the riding. Matthews had previously traced the false calls to a phone registered to, quote, Pierre Poutine, which he determined is likely a fake name. Prescott had an account with Rack9, a company that does robocalling or voice broadcasting, and which was used by, quote, Pierre Poutine, to make the false calls. The account was paid via PayPal using prepaid Visa cards bought at two drugstores in Guelph. Andrew Prescott's account was used to make legitimate calls on behalf of the campaign of Conservative candidate Marty Burke. Matthews found that both Prescott and Puritine used the same two IP addresses when logging into their accounts with Rack9. Matthews, of course, does not accuse Prescott of making the calls. Prescott declined to comment on the information contained in the court documents. Elections Canada has been investigating the misleading calls for a year. More complaints have surfaced since news broke about the investigation, and Chief Electoral Officer Mark Mayrand said March 29th that the agency is now looking into credible allegations in 200 ridings.
On Tuesday, hundreds of public sector workers marched on Prime Minister Stephen Harper's office in downtown Ottawa in a protest of budget cuts. The protests were part of International Workers' Day, and in Ottawa, they took a more modern approach to celebrating the labor movement than in the past years. In Ottawa, protesters are concerned about thousands of jobs being lost because of budget cuts, but some in the crowd are also backing striking students in Quebec. Union officials said that a group of students was barred from crossing from Quebec into Ontario to join the protest. Police surrounded the protest and were videotaping the crowd, which was boisterous but peaceful. Union President John Gordon said Tuesday's protest won't be the last the Harper government hears of the civil service. Over 12,000 workers have now been notified their jobs are on the line as the government seeks to cut $5.2 billion in spending. A total of 19,200 positions are being cut.
Former media magnate Conrad Black returned to his upscale Toronto estate a free man on Friday, embracing his wife in full view of journalists and roaming his sprawling property with his dogs following his release from a Florida prison. Black's return was a controversial subject among Canadians, some welcoming his return and others disgracing it. Black, who is now 67, was taken into custody by U.S. immigration officials earlier Friday after he was released from a Florida penitentiary, where he was serving a 42-month sentence for fraud and obstruction of justice. The former media baron was seen Friday by CBC journalists and other media outlets greeting his wife, Barbara Emile, and walking through the front door of his sprawling mansion in Toronto's Tony Brattle Path neighborhood.
Those are your provincial and national headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for your international news.
The AIDS Vancouver Helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the Helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the Helpline is one of the many programs from AIDS Vancouver combating the HIV epidemic in the Lower Mainland. While not medical professionals, our volunteers answer your questions confidentially and anonymously. The Helpline number is 604-696-4666. Or contact us at aidsvancouver.org.
I'm hungry.
Me too.
And why is she eating that stuff? She must have picked it up from her trip back home. The smell's making me sick. Don't you think she should eat it somewhere else?
No, that's disrespectful toward Parveen. Actually, I think it's great that we can enjoy different foods.
What would you do if you were this witness? Safe Harbor Respect for All provides diversity workshops across Canada with funding from the Government of Canada. Visit safeharbor.ca. Respect for all. Pass it on.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Nina Kurgia.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, or online at citr.ca. Thank you for being with us.
In an interesting piece of international news, Edvard Munch's The Scream broke records on Wednesday night as the most expensive piece of art ever sold at an auction. A private buyer bought the piece for $120 million at Sotheby's Impressionist and Modern Art Evening Sale. The vibrant pastel had been expected to sell for about $80 million, but two determined bidders were competing via telephone and emerged from an initial group of seven, driving the final price up to $107 million, or $119,922,500, including commission. In the course of a 12-minute bidding war, bids jumped several times by increments of $10 million.
TransCanada Corp. reapplied to the U.S. State Department for a presidential permit to build the controversial Keystone Pipeline, Keystone XL oil sands pipeline today, immediately triggering a new fight with opponents over the scope of a coming environmental impact study into the project. In an interview with Post Media News, TransCanada executive Alex Burbet said that Calgary-based company expects the Obama administration's review of Keystone XL to be limited to the new rerouted portion of the pipeline through Nebraska. TransCanada submitted its new application for a presidential permit just 2 weeks after it proposed several routes for Keystone XL that avoid the ecologically fragile Sand Hills region of Nebraska. President Barack Obama denied TransCanada's original permit application in January, citing his administration's concerns about the impact construction would have on the delicate topsoil in the Sand Hills region and the potential for pollution of the vast Ogallala Aquifer that underlies the area. The 2,700-kilometer Keystone XL pipeline would, if approved, carry 830,000 barrels of oil sands crude per day from the northern Alberta oil sands to refineries on the Gulf Coast of Texas. TransCanada first applied for a permit to build the pipeline across the Canada-US border in 2008.
Pipelines, 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 and not a drop to drink, isn't it, CJ?
Hopefully not.
Yeah.
For the company, at least.
Yes. Well, next we go to Democracy Now! On a May Day special on Occupy Wall Street, immigration, and labor protests. Take it away, Democracy Now!
Some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A coalition of groups spanning the labor, immigrant rights, Occupy Wall Street movements, and beyond are joining together today for nationwide demonstrations marking International Workers' Day, or May Day. Well over 100 actions are planned for around the country as a day of protest traditionally led by workers and immigrants is joined this year by added numbers from the 99%. The slogan, General Strike, No Work, No Shopping, Occupy Everywhere. May Day actions are also being held around the world as many countries observe official government holidays and hold mass demonstrations, rallies, and marches to express labor solidarity and celebrate workers' rights. Protests are planned and in some cases already underway in Toronto and Barcelona and London and Kuala Lumpur and Sydney, among hundreds of cities in North America, Europe, and Asia. Here in the United States, May Day is not a government-sanctioned holiday, even though the commemoration did originate here. On May 1, 1886, the American Federation of Labor called a national strike to put an end to the 12, 14, even 16-hour days that were commonplace then. 2 days into the massive strike, the police opened fire on a crowd of protesters in Chicago, killing four. The following day, a bomb was thrown at police officers as they descended on peaceful protesters in Haymarket Square. The bomb killed one police officer, injured many more. The police fired into the crowd, killing at least one, wounding dozens. Although it was never known who threw the bomb in Haymarket Square, the incident was used as an excuse to attack the left and labor movement. eight of Chicago's most active labor leaders were sentenced to death, four of them ultimately hanged. News of these executions sparked labor protests throughout the world, and in 1889, the Socialist International declared May 1st a day of demonstrations. This year's May Day is the first to occur after the emergence of the Occupy Wall Street movement last fall. Organizers are hoping a massive turnout today will help relaunch the movement after a winter lull and propel it into the summer months. To discuss May Day, we're hosting a roundtable discussion with four guests in our studio. Teresa Gutierrez is co-coordinator for the May 1st Coalition for Worker and Immigrant Rights. Amin Hussein is editor of Title magazine and a key facilitator of the Occupy movement in August 2011, leading the first General Assembly in Zuccotti Park. He's co-founder of the Plus Brigade, which has been central to the weekly Friday protests down at the New York Stock Exchange. Amin is a lawyer who left his job at a corporate law firm in Manhattan representing financial institutions to become an artist and activist. Chris Hedges is with us, senior fellow at the Nation Institute, former foreign correspondent for the New York Times, was part of a team of reporters that was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for the paper's coverage of global terrorism. He's author of a number of books, including Death of the Liberal Class. Among his pieces, Why I'm Suing Barack Obama. He's suing the administration over the National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, and was arrested in front of Goldman Sachs recently. Marina Citrin is with us, postdoctoral fellow at Center for Globalization and Social Change at the City University of New York, author of Horizontalism, Voices of Popular Power in Argentina. And she's also researching, preparing, and participating in global mass movements from Spain to Egypt to Greece. Most recently, she co-authored the forthcoming Occupying Language, part of the Occupied Media Pamphlet series published by Zuccotti Park Press. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Why don't we begin with Amin? I know that I don't even know if you got any sleep last night, but talk about the preparations for today and what you see happening.
I think it's been ongoing since we got thrown out of the park, and we started thinking how this movement can exist without physical space, since we became very apparent that the city wasn't going to let us have it because they recognized its power and how we organize. So we picked out May as another day to kind of build the type of solidarity that's necessary with other social movements that have already been doing stuff. So that we asked the question, where are students? Where is labor in all this? And that if you want a mass movement, which I am a person that does, we need to create that space within this movement and get to work with each other.
Teresa Gutierrez, May Day over the last years has been a mass day of movement for immigrants and people supporting immigrants' rights. Talk about how
Well, in spring 2006, we saw a tremendous upsurge of immigrant workers that took to the streets in the millions, not just once, but several times. And thanks to that struggle, May Day has been revived in this country. I think it's extremely exciting that the Occupy Wall Street movement has not only just made its effort to organize around May Day, but it's spent hours in deliberation with immigrant and labor organizations to find ways to come together. The OWS movement has a noble attitude of not applying for permits, for example. But when you are dealing with a vulnerable population such as those that are undocumented and don't just spend a night in jail but could be deported, permits, security, marshalling, those sort of things are very important on May Day. So the OWS movement was extremely and took a position to be in solidarity with immigrants. And so the message of the deportations, of legalization, has not been lost, even within the solidarity that we are putting together with OWS and labor. So this year is an important year to revive the struggle for immigrants in the wake of a million of our people being deported. So this year is very important for us.
Marina Citrin, the last decade has been major on this day.
It has been the kind of what we see now happening in New York today. You can actually go back for the last decade and see the roots of it. But I do want to say, just not just Happy May Day, but that today's already a success. I mean, that people all over the country are talking about May Day as our day, whether you want to call it workers' holiday or immigrant rights or the 99%, but that it's already part of our vocabulary again, that we've taken this really important holiday. But going back to what Teresa was saying in 2006, millions of immigrant workers organizing in the streets throughout the entire country. demanding and then continuing to organize for rights. And then that also goes back even earlier in Europe and coming out of the globalization movement, the kind of post-Seattle 1999 movements where people began to organize Euro May Day. I mean, Euro May Day was a linking of immigrant rights with precarious workers. So as more and more jobs are not unionized and workers face uneven, precarious situations of work, people started to talk about precarious work and organizing workers not just in the formal traditional trade unions. And then also injecting some of what we saw in the global justice movement of theater and play as a part of protests. So now what we're seeing planned for today is a combination of the immigrant rights movement working with the traditional labor movement, which is a part of May Day today, and in fact, in some places, there are strikes organized around the country called by unions. And then there are radical caucuses of unions that are participating. And then Occupy organizing direct actions and using theater. So you kind of see the play and the immigrant rights and precarious labor and kind of redefining what May Day is, particularly over these last 10 years.
Chris Hedges, you'll be speaking today on the issue of war.
I mean, I look at what's happened since September 17th. When Zuccotti Park was taken as the launching of a process that's probably quite long. I think of where we're headed as a revolution, and all revolutions begin long before their ostensible date. The Stamp Act of 1765 was sort of the dress rehearsal for the uprising against the British a decade later. The uprising in 1905 in Russia was the precursor, created the system by which eventually the Tsar would be overthrown. And I think that it's unfair to sort of pin this movement on a particular day or a particular action. I think it's begun. I think it's going forward. I think it could be years in the process. But I think that the power elite, the oligarchic corporate class is as corrupt, as fragile, and as decayed as bankrupt regimes in the past. 1789 in France was ungovernable. The elite had retreated into Versailles, as our elites have retreated into their gated compounds, utterly out of touch with the suffering of the ordinary American. I think that that what's happening today is momentous, not because of the numbers they may get or not get, but because this isn't going away.
We're going to break, come back. Our guests are Amin Hussein. Among his titles, he's one of the editors of Title magazine. Chris Hedges is with us, Teresa Gutierrez and Marina Citrin. This is Democracy Now! It's May Day. Back in a minute.
Thank you to Democracy Now! For that interview with Chris Hedges, who is a senior fellow at Nation Institute, and former foreign correspondent for the New York Times. Before that, you heard Marina Citrin, a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Globalization and Social Change at City University of New York. And now we go to another update from Democracy Now! On May Day and the historic protests that have been occurring around the world.
New York City, tens of thousands of protesters continued streaming into Union Square Park, then marched towards Wall Street in the evening for a General Assembly. Among them, immigrants' rights activists highlighting the plight of undocumented workers and students. Democracy Now! Spoke with one of the protesters named Guadalupe.
My name is Vani Guadalupe. I am president for CISA PACARI. La cosa más importante es que estamos pidiendo nosotros como una sociedad multicultural, multiétnica.
The most important thing that we're asking today is for a multicultural, multi-ethnic, and multinational society. We want full amnesty and the fulfillment of Obama's campaign promises. Today, we are asking once again for a leader who will make good on his word. These children have immigrant parents who are asking for the universal right to be free of borders, free of flags. We need to have work with dignity, not persecution, not deportations, and not xenophobia.
No, a la xenofobia.
Here in New York, Democracy Now!'s Mike Burke spoke with professor and Occupy organizer Jackie DeSalvo, who reflected on the history of May Day, dating back to the Haymarket Massacre, Chicago, May 1st, 1886.
I'm Jackie DeSalvo. I work with Occupy Wall Street, and I'm a liaison to the coalition that Occupy Wall Street has formed with labor and immigrant organizations and the May 1st coalition. So I work both in the Occupy Wall Street May Day Committee and on the Solidarity Coalition May Day Committee. We're coming together under a labor alliance in Occupy Wall Street, but the labor is in so much struggle right now, and it is all blacked out in the press. We organized what we're calling the 99 Pickets campaign, and there are many going on today. In fact, right now, the National Association of Broadcast and Entertainment Technicians are picketing ABC Disney. And they were going to pick up some supporters from Occupy at Bryant Square and march up to 67th Street. This morning, the New York Times reporters were out in front of the New York Times. The Newspaper Guild can't get a contract. We have over 40 labor pickets, and then a lot of pickets that are going to the 1%, the banks mainly.
And can you talk about the significance of these protests taking place today on May Day and how this fits into the history of May Day?
Yeah, it's really great that May Day is being revived. I mean, May Day was at the heart of a different kind of labor movement and a different kind of labor tradition. In fact, a general strike had been called, and in Chicago, 60,000 workers went out, and the police shot them. And there was a demonstration to protest the police violence, and in that demonstration, what was probably a police provocateur threw a bomb, and the police shot more people, and then they tried and hung four anarchists that they'd probably been wanting to go after for years, and it was called the Haymarket Massacre. A few years later in Europe, first or second international, I'm not sure, it was the 100-year anniversary of the French Revolution, that European unions proclaimed May 1st International Workers' Day, and it's been celebrated around the world ever since, particularly in Europe and Latin America. What happened here was that the 1% already early in the century were very threatened by workers celebrating a holiday that was about class struggle. And so Grover Cleveland changed the labor holiday to September. So that's when labor gets a day off. They used to just take off and strike and May Day. And then in the period of the Cold War and McCarthyism, just shortly after the passage of the Taft-Hartley Act, which has crippled the labor movement ever since, you know, the Taft-Hartley Act prohibits a union going out and strike of supporting another union or even a boycott. And it's illegal to go on a general strike. In that period, Eisenhower changed the name of May Day to Loyalty Day. So it was supposed to be a celebration of patriotism, not of class unity, but of unity with the 1%. And the unions stopped celebrating it. They had continued to celebrate somewhat during the 30s when they were in intense struggle. But when the unions got purged through the McCarthyist purge, where a lot of the militants were kicked out of the unions, labor started backing off on a lot of things, and they did not celebrate May Day anymore. In 2006, Mexicans in Los Angeles, for whom May Day was a holiday, resented the fact that May Day was no longer a holiday for them, and they were in an intense struggle over threatened. I think at that point the laws were going to declare it a felony to be illegal, and so they called for a day without immigrants. And in order to have this day, they had to leave their jobs. And so a million, not just Mexicans, but a million immigrants left their jobs and went into the streets, shut down Los Angeles. 200,000 marched in New York City, many in Chicago. And Labor Day was back on the calendar.
Baruch College English professor and Occupy organizer Jackie DeSalvo. In Union Square, we bumped into an entire baseball team, the Dodgers. Well, the tax Dodgers, that is.
We're a baseball team, and we go to bat for the 1%, not the 99%. We're the tax Dodgers, the best team that corporate money can buy.
And
And can you describe what you've got here?
Well, we got our full baseball team out here, and we've got all the best heavy hitters in corporate America who are part of our team. Verizon, GE, Citibank, ExxonMobil, Pfizer, Bank of America, Time Warner. You know them all. We're practically household names at this point.
Then the tax dodgers broke into song.
Take me out to the tax game. Bail me out with the banks. Buy me a bonus and tax rebate. Never pay nothing, not federal or state. Turn and shoot, shoot, shoot through the loopholes. It's law, so you can't complain. We're the 1, 2, 3 trillion you're out since we rigged the game. Take me out to the tax game. Flip the bird to the crown. Losers pay taxes, we take rebates. Cause we make the rules for the corporate state. And it's wham, bam, slam through the loopholes. We always win, what a game. We're the one, yes, the 1%. And we have no shame.
Go back to work, everyone. Strike's over.
Those were the tax dodgers on Democracy Now! Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Several major unions also participated in New York's May Day March. Democracy Now! Spoke to members of CWA, Communication Workers of America, TWU, Transport Workers Union, the AFL-CIO, and more.
My name is Dominic Renda. I'm with the Communication Workers of America, also known as CWA, and I'm out here because workers need to take a stand against corporate greed and against the wars that only benefit the wealthy. May Day means dignity for working people, and May Day started here in the United States, and it's important for us to recognize that. There's a lot of people who are unemployed, you know, and they deserve jobs, and a lot of people that deserve health, you know, health care, and they're not getting health insurance from their employer. Pensions are becoming a thing of the past. Unions are becoming a thing of the past. And the thing is that working people, we really need to organize, because without the unions, they would just be the very rich and the very poor.
With District Council 37 AFSCME, and I'm here today to support the efforts of May Day in fighting in the coalition to protect working families, struggling families and individuals, quite frankly known as the 99%, to make sure that our issues, our causes are not forgotten and that we are not demonized, because we need to make sure that we protect the rights and the important value of the common good, which has been lost, quite frankly, over this last year or so, whether it's fights in the labor community, fights in our communities around the city and around the country, fights to protect those most vulnerable in our populations. So this is a day that I'm very happy to be here with my union family, AFSCME, District Council 37, and many of the labor unions, faith, and community-based organizations across the city represented here.
Marvin Holland, Transport Workers Union. I'm the political director. TWU has always participated in May Day since we've restarted it back in 2006. And we're happy to say that this is probably the biggest one we've had so far. We just want to get a decent contract with perhaps some cost of living wages. We think it's time to turn the tide on the constant concessionary contracts that have been happening to state workers throughout the country.
My name is Beresford Simmons. I'm with the Taxi Workers Alliance. I've been driving a cab in New York City for over 40 years. And I'm here today to support the workers, because taxi drivers are some of the most exploited workers in New York City, and we need some attention from the authorities who are abusing us.
My name is Linda Harrison. I'm with TWU Local 100. I'm here today for workers' rights. I was one of the laid-off workers, and I just came back to work the end of March, the last week in March. It was almost 2 years when we were off, and I mean, we found money that MTA had that they could have kept us on. The services that they cut was unnecessary. And this day is a day for us to come out and unite as one. All the unions are here. Everyone's being represented. And we just want rights. We just want equality. We don't want them to give us anything. We work for whatever, you know, for our checks. They don't give us we work hard. We have, you know, sometimes dangers on the train. We have different situations where our lives are in danger. And we still have to deal with it. We have to come back to work. And we have to, you know, go through different things and trauma and all these things like that. And we just want them to just pay us for what we give back, what we give to them, our experiences, our you know, the skills that we have and things like that. Like, we're not dumb. All of us have college. They got skills. They have classes for us, so we know that they know that we have these skills, and we're just asking them to just give us what we deserve.
My name is Fitzreed. We are part of DC 37, Local 768, healthcare workers. We are here to support all the oppressed and the workers, students. We just want to get a movement going so we can redeem the dream to get back the wealth that we produce and provide for the capitalists, so we can get our fair share at minimum. The struggle should not just to maintain what we have, but we should have full health care, a universal health care, and that would take the burden off the union, so we not have to negotiate that, because all of us will get the standard care. We're all human beings, and if we cannot provide health care for the workers and for the masses, what else it becomes primary? That's a priority.
Some of the voices of organized labor at the May Day rally in New York.
There were many events in New York City's parks. In Madison Square Park, Occupy Wall Street hosted a free university where professors gave free classes to May Day protesters.
Thank you to Democracy Now! That was Amy Goodman and Nermeen Sheikh giving us an update on the Occupy protests in New York City. And now for our international headlines, we go to Free Speech Radio News.
According to Greenpeace, Japan will have a chance at a brand new energy framework beginning Saturday. The planned shutdown of the final reactor in the country could mean an end to its dependence on nuclear power and a future based on renewable energy. FSRN's Claudia Craig reports.
Since the devastating earthquake in March 2011 and the subsequent Fukushima nuclear disaster, dozens of reactors all across Japan, including those not directly affected by the tsunami, have gone offline for maintenance and safety checks. When the last of the 54 reactors switches off for maintenance, Japan will be without a single working nuclear reactor as power source for the first time in nearly 50 years. No reactor will be permitted to go back online until it passes stringent stress tests, despite the fact that Japan depends on nuclear for a massive 30% of its power supply. Among the critics of the total shutdown is Keidan Ren, the influential Japanese business lobby, and the Japan Institute for Energy Economics says a combined effect of total nuclear shutdown will cause national GDP to stagnate at just 0.1% growth this year. But a recent poll indicates about 60% of the population supports a permanent nuclear shutdown. Claudia Craig, FSRN.
Journalists are marching today in Mexico City to demand the government investigate and punish crimes against media workers. Today's protest comes on the heels of a multi-victim homicide in Veracruz. FSRN's Shannon Young reports.
The remains of two photojournalists, a former cameraman, and a newspaper administrative worker were found yesterday, World Press Freedom Day, tortured, dismembered, and dumped in plastic trash bags in a canal in Veracruz. Relatives of two of the victims, Guillermo Luna and Gabriel Uge, reported the two as missing Wednesday afternoon. The third man, Esteban Rodriguez, had worked as a crime photographer for 5 years, but left the profession last summer after the murder of two key staffers of the regional Notiver newspaper. All three had expressed serious concerns for their personal safety in 2011. The sadistic quadruple homicide came just 5 days after investigative journalist Regina Martinez was beaten and strangled to death in her home in the state capital of Veracruz. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
Also in Mexico, at least 23 people were killed today in the border city of Nuevo Laredo. The bodies of 5 men and 4 women were left hanging from an overpass early this morning, along with a large banner accusing them of having ties to a car bomb that exploded there last week. By midday, social media users were reporting another 14 bodies had been left inside of a vehicle, and 3 coolers containing human heads were discovered near City Hall. A New York police officer will not be indicted in the shooting death of a 68-year-old former Marine. Officer Anthony Corelli shot Kenneth Chamberlain in his White Plains home last year after responding to a medical alert device accidentally triggered by the African-American man. Details of the case revealed that officers who responded used racial slurs and that Chamberlain told them he didn't need assistance. Police say Chamberlain attacked them with a knife, leading to the shooting. Officer Corelli has also been linked to another police brutality incident with racial overtones. Late Thursday, Connecticut's General Assembly passed controversial legislation that will enable home care workers and daycare providers who are paid through state programs to bargain collectively over wages and benefits. FSRN's Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven.
Last year, Governor Daniel Malloy issued an executive order allowing both groups of workers, who are independent contractors, to join unions. Thursday's bill provides those workers the ability to bargain with the state for a contract. Proponents argued that improving the wages, working conditions, and training of these low-wage but essential workers would improve care for their clients. Cassandra Parkman, a home care worker from Manchester, celebrated the vote.
This is what we needed. We stand alone, we don't really have a voice, and now we're able to come together and have guidance in how to get the things that we need. You know, health insurance, better living wages, to be able to support ourselves is something tremendous.
Some opponents said unionization would undermine the personal relationship between the giver and receiver of care. The bill includes a provision that clients may still hire and fire their caregivers without a grievance procedure due to the intimate nature of the relationship. About 11,000 workers will be covered after the governor signs the legislation. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, New Haven.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
And thanks to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. You'll listen to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
That is our program for Friday, May 4th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. And if you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Nina Kurgia.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by Nina from the entire news team at CITR. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded right here on CITR 101.9 FM.